like that intro, and you might know the artist, dude.
Yeah, I wrote that song. That's
what?
What? Yeah.
You're on the vocals also?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did. That's my last. That's the song from my last album, Through Rose Colored Glasses. It's free. Actually, download on my website. But no, I played all the instruments and did all the singing on that album. Yeah.
Well, that's. I appreciate that we get to use it for our intro. And
I love it.
Welcome to another edition of Weird Connections.
Glad to be here.
My host, Eddie, and I've got some really special guests to me personally, two coaches that have just had a huge impact on my life. And I mean, you guys might have to forgive me. I might get emotional when I introduce both of you because of the impact that you guys have had. Chuck Olson, I mean, what can I say? When I had a friend from New York visit, he calls, he's visiting, and my brother Austin calls me, says, "Hey, get Brian and bring him to the Wedge." And I didn't know what was going on other than it was a big day. I mean, everybody knows when it's a big day. And so I take this guy who's never been to the Wedge, and it's, I mean, it was probably 20 feet. And we're standing there watching. And one of the things about the Wedge is if you go and stand there on a big day or on a morning, as you know, tell me if I'm describing this right, but the ocean can breathe, and you can it's like a dragon breathing, and it goes whoom, whoom.
That's a great analogy. Whoom,
like
great
this.
Analogy.
And anyway, so I mean, that we show up and it's just it's just wild, and it's cold and it's misty, and this guy's saying, "Wow, this is great." Well, here comes this monster man, the sexiest man you've ever seen in a Speedo. And I believe it was a yellow Speedo with the face of a famous guy from Baywatch. What was his name? What do we call this Speedo?
We called those the Hasselhoff specials.
So I'm sitting there with my buddy from New York who has never seen a man in a Speedo before. Chuck Olson comes out after riding a 25-foot wave, and we'll show some pictures, and hopefully we can get some pictures up. But I mean, I looked over and his jaw was just wide open, and you walked right up and introduced yourself, and he will never forget that. I will never forget that. And anyway, Chuck, I don't know if I did justice to the intro, but you're one of my idols. You're one of my heroes, and I'm just so thankful that
you
came
Thank
to
you.
Visit
that means a lot.
Us and that you got to meet Eddie and Kayvon.
Absolutely.
You know, we'll get into what you do and why you're here, and I'll introduce Kayvon as, you know, another human being that I don't know how to thank. I just handed up my son to you his freshman year in high school. You took him under your wing and turned him into a fucking NCAA athlete. I mean, Division I NCAA athlete. I'm so thankful to you, Kayvon. And so is Russell. I know he wanted to say hello to you.
Thanks. That means a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, so anyway, I don't want to get too emotional, Eddie, because I know we had our thing. But
no, you're good, man.
No. Anyway, so I want to get right into what you guys are doing, right into what you guys are after, and I told you kind of what I'm after with this is, Eddie and I want to try to build a platform for guys like you that have something to offer the world. If we can help with that, and bring people to you somehow. There's all kinds of ways to do online training, personalized training, and I want to get you guys into that kind of stuff, or have you guys talk about some of that stuff too. So we'll just get right into it. Eddie, I don't know if I showed you some of these pictures. You've been busy for the last few minutes,
Eddie, and we really appreciate it,
and we'll get to both of you guys, but
I like kind of coming into some of these cold because you're bringing in some of the most interesting people and just kind of getting to explore, you know, what you guys do kind of from an outsider's perspective is kind of nice sometimes, you know?
Throw it against the wall.
Absolutely. Exactly.
So I don't know that I have the Hasselhoff here, but this is Chuck in Jackson. Yeah, so pretty impressive stuff, right?
Hell yeah.
And see if we can I'll get you the digital.
That's hilarious. That's
maybe
great.
Maybe flash some of that stuff up here. But Chuck, why don't we lead off with you? Tell us a little about yourself and
sure.
Who you are, cool. Where'd you come from? I know
that's awesome.
It's insane, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Chuck, who's Chuck Olson? Where'd you come from? How did the Chuck Olson emerge?
Well, like
Coach Chuck. Talk to us, Coach Chuck.
Well, like most wedge body surfers, I came from Illinois. And
naturally
moved out when I was 6 years old. And it's funny you talk about that dragon. When we first lived in Corona del Mar, lived on Ocean Boulevard, which those of you that don't know, as the crow flies, sits, I would say, a mile away from the wedge. And I would lay in my back bedroom. Boom. Boom.
Hearing the waves.
Boom. And your bed is vibrating. That was my first indicator. Luckily, I had a sister who was just a hard-charging gal, great swimmer, loved the ocean, started taking me out at a smaller beach, Big Corona, and taking off on 8-foot waves, 10-foot waves. Next thing you know, the challenge was the wedge. So started heading down there.
Quit banging on the table.
No, you're fine.
No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry.
No, right before you came in, Kayvon was shaking on the door, and I said, oh, there's Chuck Olson ripping the door down.
Okay.
And that's one of the things I want to get into about you, Chuck.
I carry my energy throughout my body. I vibrate also.
He's going to break the table if I let him keep going like this.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, that's you, Chuck.
I'll put my hands in my lap.
It's very cheese tapping into the energy of the earth.
Well, and that's what the wedge does to you.
Yeah,
you know,
100%.
And that is that passion that you bring forward to you, hopefully in other sports, that energy, that wisdom, that patience, that calm. And so as I was down at the wedge on the first couple days, swimming across the Newport Harbor Channel at approximately 8-9 years old, getting threatened to be thrown in jail and going over and getting my ass absolutely handed to me on a 1-foot, 2-foot wedge wave, and the power to have something so strong, have such control of everything was just awesome. Very, very exhilarating. So through the years, as I got more into swimming, I was able to ride larger and larger waves. And, you know, there's a lot of psychology behind that. The great Fred Simpson, the late great Fred Simpson of Viper Surfing Fins, he once said, the biggest challenge is deciding to go. And it's just sitting right on that edge and deciding, I'm going. One of the greatest visions I've ever had was literally taking a wave and having the wherewithal to look forward and to be literally looking down on the lifeguard tower. Seeing the roof of the lifeguard tower told me I was absolutely in the 20-foot plus range. So for that became such an exhilarating force. It's like a drug. It was very, very addicting.
Can I ask you a question? So before you had ridden that size wave, what previously... So how big was the leap from like 6-foot waves to 20-foot, or was it like, because that seems like
That's actually a great question.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mine actually was fairly quick. To get into the wedge crew, you had to be a hard charging rider. You had to be of a different mindset. So what happened to me was I was riding, like I said, 6-8-foot waves at Big Corona, just big walls and just having fun because there wasn't a lot of penalty for it. Mm-hmm. But as my coach and Ryan's coach, Ted Bandrick, who was an absolute wild man.
God.
As he knows, not the greatest form, but there was no one who had bigger cojones than Ted Bandrick.
Nobody.
And so when he starts taking me out at about 11 years old, there was really no buffer. There was no going out in 4-foot because Ted, like many of us at the crew, wanted the biggest. So I went from about 8-foot Big Corona, which is a G ride at Disneyland, to all of a sudden the E ticket.
Right.
And all of a sudden I'm being called into waves, go, 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 and it's 15-foot.
And how old were you?
I'd say the first time I got off on a 20-foot wave, I was probably about 17,
wow.
18.
Okay.
So it went from very small to very large in literally one summer. So again, it was a matter of the bravado and hanging with the guys and wanting to be a part of watching some of these legends, Mel Thoman, Terry Wade, Greg Dietz. These are guys who were just absolute, just ballet dancers on the water, how you are able to plane and how you're able to control with such immense power.
Chuck, having grown up with you and around all of this, there's a I don't know if an urban legend or what you had called this force that was at the wedge, the walrus.
Yes.
Tell me about the wall. Tell me about the walrus.
Well, if we're talking about Ivan,
I'm talking about the roofer.
Dave Ellis.
Yes.
Dave Ellis. Yes.
Okay. So now,
well, it's funny you say the walrus because we had a gentleman, Ivan, who had a beard like a walrus.
Okay, so clear it up for me. I mean, sure. I grew up here. I know as much as anybody. I thought the walrus was Ellis. Was Ellis not the walrus?
Well, you know, there's so many nicknames, and nicknames picked up. We had Sasquatch, who turned into Cashbox. You know, the walrus was always known as Ivan, but Big Dave Ellis, you don't need a name for Dave Ellis. Dave Ellis was large and in charge.
Is he alive?
Oh, absolutely. Okay, okay. Absolutely. I see him quite frequently.
Well, see, I haven't been. The last time I saw him, I think it was at Cruisers, and I think he had quit drinking and he lost a ton of weight. And, you know, I've known him a long time just as a dad. One of the coolest dudes I've ever known, and to find out that he was who I thought was the walrus, and then to hear you talk about him is
powerful. Dave was a special guy to all of us. While Dave rode some big waves, Dave was really more of a father figure, more of a policeman, more of a kept the riffraff out.
Are you allowed to talk about any of these kinds of these little micro stories?
Yeah, they're. In the days gone by, obviously, we're in a different world, and how we police our breaks, you know, there was a lot of violence and a lot of NorCal beaches and things like that. We were never into that. But the fact of the matter is, the wedge is a wave that, as we say, when it's small, you break bones. When it's large, you just drown. Mm. So that being said, when someone's taking off at a 30-foot wave, you don't want someone taking off down the line. So there had to be repercussions. Mm-hmm. And when there's repercussions, how do we police that? And Dave was one of those, if you did something really bad, if you did something really stupid and wrist injury to somebody, you got off the beach, the story wasn't over. And so we had to police it from that matter, in the water and out of the water. And frankly, a lot of it was intimidation and the threat of violence. But I'll be honest with you, I very rarely ever from any of the wedge crew, because we garnered enough respect for what we did that it really never came to that. I can tell you in all my life, I've really never been in a fight. People find that hard to believe because I'm a very aggressive individual. But at the end of the day is respect, and that aggression kind of comes.
What's the term, two hits, I hit you, you hit the ground? I'm sure you've been in plenty of those. All right, you don't need to respond to that.
I don't know if I can remember that, but
every time
you kind of worry about what you could do to somebody.
Well, and your jewelry too is dangerous. So when I give you knuckles, I try to miss your jewelry.
Sure,
it
sure
hurts. My God, Chuck, you're a powerful human. well, and I mean, all the love and power and everything you've shown in your chosen skill or chosen what would you call the body surfing part of your life is just who you are.
You know, there's a lot of people who live and die. Mel Thoman is someone to this day who lives and dies for the wedge, and he's the one who keeps that old school spirit alive, and that spirit is amazing, and that's why the wedge crew is still known, even though we're probably on our fourth now generation of wedge crew members. But for myself, wedge was always a passion that served other purposes also. I use it, and I'm sure we're going to get into it, that I coach swimming and I coach age group swimming. And part of that wedge passion is a lot of the things when you're out at pipeline and you get thrown on the reef and then you're held down for three waves. You really have no choice but to maintain a calm, cool demeanor, because otherwise then you drown. And so that carries over so much to sports, you know, that inner versus external communication that you're receiving versus how and what you're talking to yourself.
Chuck, thanks a lot. I just, and I'll get back to it, but I had just a question. So in the as the wedge evolved and boogie boards started to come in, I'm sure that was a lot of the issue. But then all of a sudden,
it was.
You actually had guys like Purdy show up and start yes. surfing those 30-foot waves.
Correct.
And so my question to you is Purdy considered part of the wedge crew?
Well, you know, there's two definitions of wedge crew. Wedge crew has always been traditionally the kneeboarders, the body surfers, nothing more. There was no boogie boards. And in fact, if any of you ever seen Dirty Old Wedge, one of the clips on there was me basically explaining what happened when the boogie board was invented. And essentially that was my statement, to paraphrase, was simply when someone comes to your door, they knock on your door and say, hey, I'm moving in. And by the way, I'm bringing 500 of my closest friends. Things aren't going to end well. And so there was a lot of that mystique of how we handled and how we policed it. Now, keep in mind, a lot of it was, yes, because we do want our wave to ourselves. But however, with video, with photo sharing, with the internet, that was all just expanding through the roof. So there was really no way to just simply limit, you know, who could see what's going on there. So to answer your question, Spencer Purdy, highest and highest of respect, Bobby Oakvist. But we all have to remember, it all started with Joe Neely, and this even predates Danny Kwok of Quicksilver fame. But those were some of the first two guys to ever board surf the wedge. And it was that their demeanor and their acceptance and the ability to ride actually with a board rider, because we're riding on two different planes, two different levels. So
I haven't seen any of that footage. I mean, is there footage of those guys riding?
Oh, 100%.
Why isn't it out there?
Not too much video because,
well, that's what I mean,
because so, it was the big 40-pound camcorders, right. And they weren't down there, and even projecting wasn't
there. We
should
get some of that video out. I think that'd be really neat to see.
Some of the still shots alone really convey mm-hmm. the power and the ferocity.
And then, of course, we can't talk about the wedge without talking about Ben. Maybe just mention that.
Sure. Ben Carlson is someone who served the Newport Beach, the lifeguarding community. Ben Carlson gave his life in the line of duty. First Newport Beach lifeguard to ever pass away in the line of duty. And Ben was just a great kid. We first met him down at the Wedge as he was first starting his career as a tower guard. And he eventually found his love of the boats and went on to the boats. But Ben, for those that don't know, Ben ended up being concussed, essentially, about 15th Street on a rescue. Victim, doing his job, survived. Ben was later found around the Newport Beach Pier area.
Did he come off the boat?
You're going to start getting me going.
Okay, so no, I'm glad you cleared that up, because I thought it happened at the Wedge.
No, it did not happen at the Wedge, right.
Okay.
But Ben, again,
so it's closer to the point.
Correct. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Which can be even heavier on different swells.
Well, quick diversion here. Go back to 1978. Ted Bandrick has talked me into going into junior lifeguards. I'm at the Newport Pier. It is the big swell of 78. Newport Point is about 30 to 35 foot. My sister takes me out swimming because we had friends within the lifeguard department. And so went out and then board surfed by the Newport Pier later. I'm sitting next to the Newport Pier with about four other guys, show you the date, Maury Doyles, and all of a sudden people are yelling at the pier, hey, someone's down there, and I'm just paddling out. And I'll be honest, and this is where training really does, without forethought, comes through, and that is I froze. I'll be honest with you. Someone's down there. My buddies are off, and we're all 14, 15. They're diving off by the pilings trying to find this body, and I just sat there reaching down. Oh, I hope I don't find anything. And you bring the mountain to the man, or the man to the mountain. And the mountain came to me, and floating up underneath me was this Vic, who essentially, he died. So I'm doing CPR, getting pushed in on the board until the real lifeguards took effect. And that was my first introduction to death and the ocean. And wow. Yeah, crazy.
At 14.
Still hits me. Still, to this day,
yeah,
moves me.
Was that the swell that produced that infamous picture at the Big Corona?
Off the end? Yes. Okay. 78. Yes, 78. You're right. There were so many at that time, but 78 produced so many amazing photos. But yes, you are correct. Yeah.
Well, Chuck, I mean, I could just keep going with you all day because you're my hero. But I want to
choose your Kayvon heroes
and mention Kayvon. Kayvon, say your last name for him.
Amin Zadeh.
All right. Yeah. Kayvon Amin Zadeh. I already gave you your intro on how much you mean to me, and it's just fantastic what you've done for my son as an athlete. I want to just give you the mic and tell us who you are and what you're doing. I know you spent the last at least 5 years at Corona Del Mar High School with a full time or with a that was considered a full time job.
Yeah, I was coaching track and football and doing strength and conditioning.
Right, okay,
since 2021, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was just wearing a bunch of different hats. I'm a coach. I was doing it in the weight room, on the track, and football, and I kind of liked bringing in all of them together. So I'd always try to get the football guys out to run track, and I really thought I helped them on the field. So yeah, that's what I did for the last few years. I learned from my mentor, Gary Kablein, doing private training with Evo Sports Training, and I just kind of took everything I learned from him since 2018 and tried to apply that to my own world. And, it's been a pleasure. It's been fun. I think my passion is helping people just improve moving on the field. I think the weight room, complements what people do on the field and on the track, and it's kind of always changing, and I'm just trying to keep up with it, yeah. So, yeah.
As I was looking through your resume, I noticed a couple big names, but one that stands out to me, of course, is DeSean Jackson, Cal Bear, and I happened to see him play a few times, and what an outstanding athlete that guy is. But one of the things, and that's kind of one of the things I wanted to talk to both of you guys about, is attitude. And we can go back to the wedge and these big waves. But attitude is one of those intangibles, however you say it, is are you born with attitude? Can you learn attitude? What do you think? What's your take on that?
I think attitude is taught. I think it's, if you talk about nature versus nurture, I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it's about how you're raised. Russell had a lot of attitude. I think that's your son Russell playing football. I think that's one of his biggest traits, and that's why where he's at today. But it doesn't have to be vocal. Sometimes it comes out being vocal. Sometimes it just comes out with the intensity that you play with and just like the mental edge and attitude you have and the way you approach life, not just a sport. Are you first person in, first person out of the weight room, on the track, on the field? Are you when competition comes, like, what does that make of you? Are you going to get in a dogfight? So that's what I think of attitude. People like DeSean Jackson definitely is an athlete with attitude. You see him at his training sessions and, he always wants to make competition out of something. It just becomes more interesting and more fun rather than just getting through the workout. When I would work at Evo and under, I got the pleasure to see DeSean train and assist with Coach Gary's training when he was working with DeSean, it'd be a lot of shit talking, a lot of like getting people riled up, racing, let's race, and that's how you get more out of everyone. So,
interesting.
Yeah, I think attitude just brings out competition and I think it's developed and it's got to be developed, every day.
Is there anyone that just jumps to your mind that's just an outlier in the attitude category?
Yeah, I mean, another person recently is who started working with Evo and the company that I work with is Amon-Ra St. Brown, and he's, if you watch him play, he plays with attitude. He's a physical being. He loves just competition, just like what we've talked about with DeSean, and he doesn't shy away from contact. Receivers kind of get the stigma that they're soft. If you watch Amon-Ra play, that's not even close to what he is. Like, he's seeking out contact in the run game. He's another lineman on the field. So I think Amon-Ra's another person that shows that.
Okay, and this is going to reveal how little I know. The coach for the Lions what's his name?
Dan Campbell.
Okay.
Yeah.
He had a clip recently where he shows a guy that's blocking when at the end of a game for no, they're like losing the game by a lot, and this guy's going out. Is that Amon Ra?
Yeah, that's Amon Ra.
Okay,
yeah,
God, yeah. I thought that's the,
yeah.
So yeah, and he says, he goes through, he goes, fuck you, and then he goes, hits the night, he goes, fuck you,
yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah.
That is an awesome video.
Yeah.
So, well, okay, so that is attitude, right? That, okay, and that's the attitude you're talking about. That's the attitude that Dan Campbell was talking about.
Yeah, just wanting to kick someone's ass.
You right.
know, after the whistle, before the whistle,
right,
definitely
right.
between the whistles.
If I may interject, being a Chicago Bear fan,
yeah.
Walter Payton was always, if I'm going to get hit or if there's going to be contact made, I'm going to apply the contact. You know, so Walter Payton was running with the ball, and he was hitting the other guys. The mm-hmm. other guys were not hitting him.
Yeah.
Attitude.
Yeah.
Kayvon, and I'd like you to tell us what you're doing at Oregon now. I think it's a loss for Corona Del Mar that they don't have you. I don't know what happened with that, or if there's any hard feelings. And the reason I say that is because I've been around enough to know when you have a good coach and you let him go, it has an effect on the whole program. So. If I knew you were leaving, I would have said something to somebody. But I'm guessing that you are making a career move of some sorts. Tell us what you're doing up in Oregon.
So I'm interning at Oregon right now. I think it was just the right time for me. I've always wanted to check out that world, and I'm loving it. I'm enjoying it. So Oregon's kind of known for you know being the Nike, you know, speed. And my whole life has been bringing speed to football and being a part of that. I found passion in getting football players to go run track and getting track athletes to go play football and kind of the collaboration of both. And, you know, I connected with this coach, Kyle Bolton, while he was at TCU. He blew up about, you know, bringing speed training into the football world and what he was doing in-season training, having guys doing sled excels all the way through the season into playoffs. And that year, TCU went to the national championship. Years later, now he's at Oregon. I met him at a coaching conference before he got to Oregon, and I just, congratulated him when he got there. I saw an opening for an internship, and I just saw it as an opportunity. I texted him, and he got my foot in the door. I've been there now, and, you know, I went from wearing a bunch of different hats at CDM, and it's kind of refreshing to feel like I could put all my energy into one thing. I feel like I've reached a new personal level of discipline. I'm waking up at 3:45 in the morning to be the first person in the weight room. I don't have to be there till 5, but I want to be there by before 4:30. So, you know, I could get the weight room set up, and it's been humbling. You know, I go there, and my job is to make sure everything's organized. The lifts are set up with the other teammates on my intern crew, and I just want to make the most of it. If I'm going to leave something I loved like I did at CDM, I'm not going to waste any time. So I'm putting in the extra hours. I am the first person in, last person out, and I'm just there to be a sponge right now. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
You know, yeah. it's that point I think that a lot of people don't understand about coaches is servitude. I spent many years in the hospitality industry, and I'll tell you, if you're not afraid to do the dirty work, then a lot of other people won't do it, or they don't even know it's being done. So I applaud you for taking that to task to be there early and get the stuff done that most people probably don't even recognize.
I appreciate that. That's what I try to focus on. There's times where, you know, I keep my mouth shut, but there's times where I feel like I want to, you know, interject and I want to put, more of what I've learned out there. But I also don't want to step on toes, and I want to take it as an opportunity to learn. But when after a couple of weeks, you know, I got the, you know, pleasure to and the trust from the coaching staff to work with a group of athletes. So they gave me the special teams athletes. I'm programming and training them on their sprint work, on their weight room, and, you know, whatever they trust me with, whenever they give me another job, another task, another group of athletes to work with, and, you know, that's the next group up. And so it's been fun. You know, I feel like I've helped these athletes, the special teams athletes, get a lot stronger. We actually, out of all position groups, showed the biggest strength gains out of all position groups in the first 5 weeks of lifting after we finished our testing. So, that was like a big thing for me. Yeah, big milestone for me. You know, it kind of just showed what I've learned, isn't lost. You know, it's getting put to use, and, I'm excited. Whatever they need me for, that's what I'll do, so.
So you're living in Oregon now.
Yeah.
If somebody needed personalized training from you, they'd need to visit you in Oregon.
Yeah.
But have you looked into, or do you know of an online way, or is there a what's holding somebody like you back from doing online training?
For me, I think,
or if you just need a kid, and you could,
I think I
give him some magic through that window.
I personally, I could do the online thing. I think, some online and over the phone stuff is happening organically with some of the athletes I used to work with. They send me videos of them at track practice or at their track meet, and I'll just give little tips on what I think they need to focus on. I send workouts to some track athletes. So that's just kind of happening organically, but I just, if it's later in the day, I do have time to train an athlete there. I was thinking about, potentially getting my foot in the door with maybe some high school athletes around the area to help some athletes there. I do think coaching happens the best at, when you get to get personal with an athlete one-on-one or in a group setting, but it's more about the relationship you build with these athletes. I think, I built a really close relationship with Russell, and that's when you see like big improvements.
Trust has a lot to do with that, I think, because athletes are fed so much information from so many different sources who have interests in their success. And so that relationship, definitely the trust, is what we try to build.
Now I think I can juxtapose between the two of you and with the word fear, and that's a word that I want to dive into and get your take on. I think of when you're talking to some of these guys that are running down the field on a kickoff to go make a tackle. That's got to be almost or equal to the same feeling as being on a 30-foot wave and the adrenaline and the feeling and the rush that you – and then to the point you made is that you – I forget how you said it, but you decide, you make that decision to go. I would imagine there's only a few people that are missing that fear gene or don't feel that fear. How do you teach a kid to get over that? How do you teach a kid to go?
I believe, and I would ask you, is it a lot of just instinctual? Because initially there is that just innate fear of the consequences. But familiarity, as we know, breeds confidence. And the same thing as running back a kickoff, or as Fred Simpson said, deciding to go. Once you build more of that confidence, then I believe it's more just an innate skill or decision that just comes naturally from inside. But in the beginning, we have to kind of quantify fear. What could happen? In some cases, the consequences is you fumble the ball or you get hit. In some cases, you break a bone. Some cases, you die, depending upon the skill. So I think that innateness kind of is developed.
I think it's exactly what you talked about from your experience. It's repetition. And, you wanted to be part of the tribe. You started off on these 6-foot waves, 8-foot waves. And then, you saw your tribe jumping over to the 20-foot waves. And it was...
The consequences of not going.
Yeah. Well, and I want to ask you, was that 20-foot wave, did that feel the same for your first 6-foot wave? You know what I mean? Because fear's got to change, and it's just all perception, right? So
in the beginning, when it was smaller, to have your older sister call you a wussy or whatever, that brought about a fear. Yeah. When the boys at the wedge say, okay, you finally have enough skill, we're going to set you up for this wave. And they start saying, go, which, by the way, they always think that maybe you should go, but I wouldn't go. But they're telling you to go. And so it's that fear. If I don't go, what are the repercussions? And that is ridicule. That could be never getting that opportunity for another good wave again. So they're sending you off into some pretty ugly, bad stuff just to see if you'll go. And if you don't go, then you're not part of the boys.
Yeah.
Kayvon, do you see that in the football world or the track world, that what Chuck just described was a group that's supporting a younger guy for success?
Yeah, I think that's true, especially at the high school level. I mean, you get incoming freshmen, and football. Maybe I'll say the jump is after freshman year, after you play freshman football and you're part of the varsity football team. You got to line up against someone that's maybe twice your size, and maybe first week we're doing hitting drills. And, you're either going to back down, and you're going to hesitate when, and you'll still get put on the ground, you know, or you're going to bring 100%, you know, full speed, full effort, and try to knock that guy's ass out. And, you know, like, maybe you still get knocked on the ground, but you make him feel it a little bit more. And that's part of that little progression, I think. But you're not, you know, you're not going to, you have your whole team watching you. You know, you don't want to just, you want to make sure you're stepping up to the plate when those situations come in. So I think the social aspect is huge.
Yep, I agree.
Eddie, I want to fold you in on this fear discussion, because I know you've had to put yourself out there in your craft and up on stage and that sort of thing. How have you managed fear?
You know, I guess that's a good question as far as like the performance stuff goes. You know, when I was real young, when I was much younger, I used to play baseball up into high school. And when I remember, and I'm sure you'll be able to relate, and I'm sure you will too, when you're in the middle of something, when you really allow yourself to be in it, and everything else just kind of falls away. It's what my father called having a Zen moment. It's just you're kind of one with everything. And I'm sure surfing, that comes all the time. You experience that. You kind of have to. It kind of demands your attention. The moment demands your attention. Football, too. I mean, you're getting, you know, you're up against a 6'2", you know, 300-pound lineman. Like, you got to be making the right decisions in the moment, on the ball. Yep. There is no time to think. It's just that your body is just doing it and you're reacting. So having those moments and experiencing that through baseball as I grew up, once I started performing, like, yeah, you get the butterflies. You get the, holy shit, there's 5,000 people out there about to, like, watch me play. But when you start, that all falls away. You don't hear anything else. You almost don't see the crowd. It's like, if you can allow yourself to slip into the moment and just kind of stop thinking and allow yourself to just go into, allow your instinctual self to just kind of take over, you know, and I find that that kind of nullifies that fear, you know what I mean? Like, in the moment, and I'm talking about, like, in real time, as, like, we're experiencing it, as we're going into these things, you know. For me, like I said, on stage, when I start and I just kind of let it melt away and let the crowd and all the other outside nonsense melt away and I just allow myself to do what I know I can do and be one with everything, that's when that fear kind of goes away. And consequently, that's when you start to really, like, build that confidence. And you're like, wow, like, not only am I confident about this, but I'm good at it. Like, I fucking enjoy this, man. Like, and I felt something, like, some oneness with things, you know. Like, that's, people go their entire lives without ever experiencing a moment like that, you know? And so I find that that's one of the things that really kind of, you know, helps me mitigate the fear or helps me move forward and find the confidence to, you know, have that regularity in what you do. You know what I mean? Like you said, you know.
I get that feeling through podcasting.
There you go. Well, you're in the right space then, aren't you?
Well, sorry, Chuck. To your point about the fear and then the like I said, to juxtapose it into all three of you guys and that this fear thing is, I'd like to mention my favorite president of all time, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton apparently, before he gave a speech, would go through this wind-up routine. Do you have a similar routine where you wind up your voice, wind up your mind?
No, what? No. Okay. I never got into that. I should have. And I never had vocal training or anything like that, and I really should have, you know. But I never did that. Even with baseball, with martial arts, with music, there was never I never put myself through some sort of like ritual. I just get up there, grab the mic, and go.
Okay, let me ask you this. Remember we were talking about the book I was reading, Eat That Frog?
Yep.
And the entire focus of the book is to plan your day ahead of time. Do you do that?
I have a morning routine. So my morning routine consists of four major things. So one, it's meditation for 5 to 15 minutes before I even get out of bed. Number two, it's a vision board. Our mind doesn't work in words. It works in pictures. It works in visuals. So what I do is I made myself a YouTube video of, like, the things that I want to see in my life and the things that I want to see with my own eyes, and then my own voice in the background saying, I am so happy and grateful that You know, I am married to the woman of my dreams. I am so happy and grateful that, you know, we live in the home of our dreams. I'm so happy and grateful that I make, you know, $10,000 a month doing what I love. I'm so happy and grateful that I'm able to do this, you know. And so I watch that every morning. It's about 5-minute video. So that's my vision board, you know. I read my life story. I put my life story into one page, who I am, what I do with my life, how I affect those around me, the community, the love, abundance, strength, and things along those lines, and, you know. And then I read that. You know, that's my who I am, my story. And then I write down my gratitudes. I am so happy and grateful that, you know, I have a roof over my head. I am so happy and grateful that my dogs are happy and healthy. I am so happy and grateful that I make this type of money, that I am married to the woman of my dreams. And those four things, when I do those and when I can get into an actual routine of every single day doing that, I find that for me, that's like been one of the things that like actually has helped me really get myself in order. You know, before that, I was kind of all over the place. I was a little bit scattered. You know, I'm not really sure with what I wanted to do, you know, in general. But that type of thing, that routine, that morning routine, I don't necessarily know that I do things throughout the day, but that one thing has definitely helped and like been a huge deal to me.
Kayvon, you have a similar morning routine?
Yeah, actually, you know, the uncertainty stress of the new position, and like I got comfortable, you know, knowing when my next paycheck was when I was working at CDM, but, you know, interning at Oregon, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty and there's fear in that. But I actually did practice gratefulness. I'd wake up, I'd journal, and praying are two things that kind of take that stress away. Mm-hmm. It helps you kind of like process, is this real? It's not happening right now. You know, it's just, again, it's just all perception. So mm-hmm. for me, practicing gratefulness and journaling and praying takes that stress away. And days that I'm not perfect, you know, there's days that I don't do that. And if I go 2-3 days without practicing that, like that anxiety comes back.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that anxiety comes back. It's like, oh, I need to get back on my shit, you know?
Yeah, so, it is a practice thing too, because the world demands your attention. You're constantly being bombarded with things, not only the things on TV, but on your phone and your friends and your situations and things like that. So if you don't actively practice being a participant in your own self-health and, you know, mental health, then the world is going to take that role for you. It's going to fill your mind and your body with all the garbage. And we're receptacles. We are, you know, we are filling ourselves with, you know, the news and all the stuff. And we choose. Do we fill ourselves with, and our minds and our hearts with good things, positivity, abundance, love, or do we let society fill it with garbage, fighting, political craziness? You know what I'm saying? So, and when we do that, and we practice gratitude, we practice abundance, we practice that self-care, it really does help. But it is we're like in this thing. It's a lifelong thing, you know. So it's so hard to just like, it's not like you do it for, you know, everybody. I think somebody said like, oh, you do something for 21 days and it becomes a lifelong habit. Like bullshit. Yep. Bullshit.
Stop doing it for 2 days.
And it doesn't. Exactly. So, I mean.
Well, on the gratitude front, that's a good segue into thanking our hosts, Gersh. Thank you, Gersh.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
Neil and Steven, of course.
Yes,
and
the producer.
Andrew,
yeah.
Eddie, thank you.
Appreciate you guys.
Pacific Lens Studios.
Ah, man. This is
okay,
a beautiful
Chuck,
place.
Your morning routine. What is Chuck Olson? Chuck Olson. Let me put this another way. What is Chuck Olson's inner voice saying when Chuck Olson wakes up?
Sure. Well, I'm going to transition into that by saying this. I fell off my way for quite a while. I coached for years, got into hospitality, worked it for years, and started to find myself getting inundated. Having a few more years on all of you gentlemen, I believe, is that I allowed some of the distractions that are now so bountiful and plentiful around us, the internet, Facebook, Instagram, all those things, the news, the accessibility of all these news sources, regardless of where you lean, it was a matter of you're constantly being talked to, and your own mind gets so cluttered that, I'll be honest, up until about 3 years ago, I was a mess. And I say that only in the sense that I think my life kind of lost purpose. It lost what I was here for and what my true skills were. And so one of the things I do is I do nothing. I unplug.
I love that.
I don't I don't go on the internet. I mean, literally from today, from 3-4 years ago, I spend probably 5% of the time I used to. I got inundated. Wow. So I say to all young kids, you know, mindfulness and separation.
Absolutely.
Listen to music. Music yes. to me has been one of the greatest things to come back to my life. I've always loved music. I grew up in a great, at a great age where we had everything from disco to punk to hard rock to heavy metal. And so different genres will fill different needs. I'll tell you right now, I may be feeling very slow. So this is my closest thing to a routine. I get in the shower and I'll put on some Dead Kennedys. Nice. I'll put on some Clash.
Love it.
I'll put on some Eminem. I'll put on some Bee Gees. You know, a little bit of everything, you know, just kind of, and I can tell you, I walk into the shower and just listening to that music and I step out, my mind has changed just like that. And so for me, it's not so much of having a routine of what to do, it's a routine of what not to do and what not to fall into. I said, 21 days of doing something is great, stop doing it for 2 days
yep.
and it's over. Yeah. Or it could be over. So it's me more or less just monitoring where my mindfulness is.
I love that.
And that is for me to even reflect on a day-to-day basis. Some of the cases I'm working with some kids. I have a child who swims for me at Corona Del Mar High School. I hear the story of him going in and while we're cleaning the pool deck and whatnot, half-heartedly, he's in there picking up handfuls of paper wads that the boys got in a fight with, and he's in there by himself.
Cleaning up.
Until I'm told, and he's just picking it up. No one's told him to. No one's asked him to. One of the other boys came and said, hey, do you know what David is doing? And I heard that. That kid's my hero. You know, so thinking about those situations, and I think one thing we kind of talk about is modeling. You know, I don't have to learn from my mistakes. I can learn from your mistakes.
Oh, my God.
I can learn from your mistakes.
You don't
have to rewrite it.
You don't have to pay the idiot tax.
100%.
Find the person who's already fallen into those pitfalls and ask him, hey, man, how'd you avoid this? How did you get to where you are 100%. Right now? I don't want to fall into those pitfalls. I don't want to have to pay the idiot tax. Help me out here. And it's funny enough, when you do that, when you ask for help, when you ask someone who's already been there for help, two things happen. One is when they say yes, you become an investment of theirs. You become a personal investment of that person's because you've come to them and said, will you help me? And when that person says, absolutely, now you, it's almost like you're building a mentorship, menteeship type of a
100%. You know, one of the words I use, and I talk to the husbands and wives out there at this level, and I say one thing to the kids, and the word is surrender. I have kids who fight every step of the way, no matter whether we're talking about how to clean up the pool deck, how to swim, how to play water polo, how this. It's essentially surrendering and just saying, look, there's bigger battles in this world. And I've been married now to Ronnie, the love of my life, knew it the moment I met her. And that is there are times when I stand my ground and we'll butt heads. But then at the end, it's not a big enough issue, but surrendering and saying, look, this isn't something worth fighting over. Mm-hmm. And I don't even mean bickering. I just mean it's nothing fighting internally.
Right.
You know, it's just a matter of saying, I have other things to focus on mm-hmm. and the positivity. To make one other analogy, I have a young lady, Chloe, who swims. And she, at her ability, is far below that of the prestigious Corona Del Mar. Now, what happened was, is she comes along and she's the only girl on the pool deck with 65 guys because the girls are still playing water polo. Chloe, I was worried about rescuing her in the beginning, but she came every day and swam. And I said, how are you finding the strength to do this? And she says, because I need to, because I live here and I want to take advantage of this great environment. And so I can either just say, well, I'm going to avoid the whole situation and then I'm still in the same place. Or I can just say, forget about my feelings, forget about the anxiety inside of me and basically just say, this is good for me. And so do it.
Yep.
You know, modeling again, just saying, I look at all these great female and male athletes and how did they get here? They started where I did.
Yes.
And again, one of my heroes.
Yeah. Everybody had a day one.
Everybody has a day one.
You know, and you did say something in there. One other thing I just wanted to make a point about. You said you don't touch the internet for a while, in general, as much as you did, but you don't, like, in the morning when you wake up, you control what you don't do. Does that mean you don't, like, grab your phone and go scrolling for the first hour or so.
I wish I could be that altruistic. No, but what I'm looking at, though, are things at a much smaller scale.
I understand.
Like I said, and to be honest, without politics, I look at several news sources.
Sure.
But I look at all of them for 5 minutes maximum.
And you're done.
And then I'm done.
Gotcha.
I want to see what has happened in the world. If it's worthy, I move on.
Sure.
But most of the time I find it's not.
You know, the reason I ask that is because, you know, I have heard that if you can, I think it was Ed Milet that said this. He was talking about how if you can control your first 30 minutes of your day and your last 30 minutes of your day, everything else in between,
yeah,
can, you know, you can kind of, you know, get a hold of. But if you cannot pick up your phone for the first 30 minutes of the day and just drink some water, meditate a little, go outside, you know what I mean? Like touch some grass, you know what I mean? Like get in the surf a little bit, you know what I mean?
Well, go back to the morning routine. My morning routine is I let the cats out when they tell me it's time to be let out.
There you go.
And then I go feed my squirrels.
Nice,
and
like that.
And I feed the birds, and it brings me more into nature.
I love that.
And so for that, I'm literally trying to stay detached from the peripheral,
yes,
BS that, frankly, I can't control.
Yes.
And that's one of the things is people focus on things that they can't control. And
100%.
We see it mostly in politics nowadays.
100%.
Whether you lean left or right, it doesn't matter.
And that's why when you
can vote and you can, you know.
Yeah. And that's why when you grab your phone first thing in the morning and you pick it up and all of a sudden you're pissed off at the first thing, political thing you see, that now sets the tone for your day.
Absolutely.
Whereas if you can take 5, 15, 20 minutes, find your center, and then literally just find your own center. And then you go out throughout your day. When one of those external circumstances pulls you off your center, you can far more easily return to center because you're familiar with it. You know where it is. You've put yourself there before. You pick up your phone instead and let, you know, the political landscape or the foreign, you know, foreign politics landscape or whatever it is take you out and get you angry. You center yourself. You know where that is. You find it. And then all of a sudden, you know, Joe Schmo, who, you know, cuts you off in traffic and flips you off, you're not so angry about it. You refind your center so much more quickly, you know?
I think recognizing those moments before they grow into something more, because
we are
all human. You know, you catch the ball and you're ready to return and you see, you know, guys running at you, there might be that innate fear. But once you take off, as you say, you make that decision to go, then your mind slips into a second gear or a different gear. And again, I will pick up that phone when I wake up to see if I have any emails,
right,
or messages. But then immediately after that, I'm either in my jacuzzi feeding the squirrels or I'm in the shower listening to music and my attitude changes just like that.
You're like me and everyone else. We all try. I try not to pick up my phone, but like I know I'm going to have 8 texts from work, from my dad, from every, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's hard. It's very difficult. But like we were talking about, it's a practice thing. It really is. It's like one of those things like, all right, no, I'm not doing that. You know what I mean? But it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I would say well over 90% of people who have a cell phone, that's the first thing they do in the morning is pick it up and look at it and check the notifications.
It's your clock next to your bed.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's your alarm. For most people, literally, it's 100%. Most people's alarm.
Yeah. I try to tell myself that I want to use my phone and the internet as a tool rather than a source for...
Well said.
A source for entertainment.
Yeah, you know, an outlet of that, of that kind.
Exactly.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So, like, when I remind myself that this is a tool, and I think that's what everyone needs
to
be
utilizing
taught,
it as a resource.
Then you only use it as a resource. What can I get out of this?
Smart.
I like that.
Smart.
Yeah.
Eddie, you mentioned the idiot tax. I like that. And I'd just like to declare I've paid more in idiot taxes than all three of you combined. So, but there's an old cowboy quote that says that wisdom comes through experience and experience comes through bad decisions. So
that makes
me more wise than all three of you put together as well. So, but I want to go back to the surrender, and you guys mentioned some really key terms and things that I really want to get into with psychologists and all kinds of coaches and just anybody. But you guys really hit the big ones is mindfulness. I mean, that's a huge topic right now. There's a professor at Stanford, Carol Dweck. I think we were talking about mm-hmm. her, and she wrote a book called Mindfulness and how you get into a growth mindset. And I really want to talk to you, Kayvon, about that, because I'm sure everybody at Oregon is talking about a growth mindset. Am I wrong?
No, they are definitely. I think it's something that as actually Dan Lanning preaches it almost every single day to the athletes after practice. And, you know, he reminds the athletes, like, hey, did you guys, each and every one of you, did you guys have your best day today? And if you didn't, how can you get there? And if you did, how can you stay there? So I think that's the part of where growth mindset is. It's kind of staying in the now, kind of staying in the present, and not letting those fears come in of, you know, the past, what happened in the past, maybe, you know, what could potentially happen in the future that's good or bad. But just staying in the present and just self-evaluating, like, what did I do today? Was I the best I could be? Yes, I was. Okay, how am I going to stay here tomorrow? How am I going to get back here and be consistent? So that's something I love that Dan Lanning preaches and kind of been sticking with me, and I try to apply to my daily life. Yeah,
and I'm sure you're not allowed to reveal any of the Oregon Ducks secrets, but give us just something that you think they do differently than others, because they for some reason they're always up there at the top. What is it about Oregon?
From the time I've been there, man, I think it's a cultural thing. I think it is your tribe. You know, there's kind of a standard that's been set. People bring each other up, and competition's part of that. You know, there's these guys have all the newcomers, all the freshmen, transfers practicing on one part of the field, and all the players that have you know, that are starting, and kind of the familiar players from the last season. And there's two practices going on at the same time, and the newcomers have to, you know, battle that out and show success on that field to go up one field. It's almost like a big tournament. Yeah, I think competition, culture, and just a standard and an expectation that you have to meet on a daily basis. Yeah.
Do mostly all the athletes get along, or are there some real real tension there?
There,
because I can imagine, you know, we can get into a competition and we can be fierce about it, and then be friends afterwards. But sometimes I would imagine it gets goes a little beyond where I want to hurt you so that I don't have to deal with you tomorrow. Is there any of that? What I'm trying to come up with is what really makes it an elite championship team that year after year, there's got to be something more than,
I mean, yeah.
And so that's why I say you have a secret window into Oregon, and not to blow smoke up Oregon, but
On the same team, and everybody's shooting for the same goal. But I mean, head strength coach Wilson Love says it in the weight room, and he tries to preach this to our guys also every day. He said, "You're here to take a motherfucker's job, right?" So and have that attitude. Like, don't worry about, like, yeah, you see these guys, and you may be friends outside of practice, outside of the weight room, but every time you're in the weight room, you're competing. You're trying to lift more weight. You're trying to show more focus. You're trying to take a motherfucker's job, because that's at that level. I mean, you know, your future, your livelihood's on the line. You're so close to making it to the NFL. A lot of these guys are making money nowadays. It is your future, your livelihood, your family's future on the line. So, like, although you guys, you know, may be cordial to each other, you know, person to person, whenever there's an opportunity to compete on the field in the weight room, like, you're trying to take a motherfucker's job.
I'd like to interject something. The great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said, "You can't learn to win if you don't learn to lose." And when you're going through those battles day to day in practices or in life, you got fired from your job, you didn't make varsity, it's how do you react? How do you come back from that? Because we're all going to be losers at one point or another in our lives. I mean, it's just unavoidable. So it's how you rebound.
Yep. I guarantee you that it was losing one or two games at a real young age that made Kobe Bryant become obsessively first guy in the door, last guy to leave, that type of basketball player. It's when you experience, you're absolutely right. It's when you get to experience the extremes. You know, when you get to experience that loss and you were at the championship game and you're that is what breeds winners, man. To like, it makes you go, never again. Never will I miss that catch again. I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that I'm just a little faster next time, that I'm just a little stronger next time. You know?
And there's the macho approach on how you deal with that. You know, I'm not going to lose this time. I'm never going to lose again. You know, Babe Ruth had kind of a flippant comment that said, basically, every strikeout puts me closer to the next home run.
Sure.
Simple as that. And I can see him saying that with a smirk and a smile and probably right. a cigar and a beer in his hand. Right. You know?
Well, I'm going to look up that quote that you mentioned from Kareem, mm-hmm. and because I don't believe it. I don't think Kareem ever lost at anything. And if he did lose, I'm sure he meant to lose because Kareem is – an alien from another planet that yep. decides.
Feel free to look it up. He's credited.
You're telling me Kareem ever lost at anything?
I mean,
no.
Didn't he play?
We all lose in personal battles.
Kareem never lost.
Did he ever miss a free throw?
Not that I can remember. I mean, well, anyway, not on purpose. I would say Kareem is the greatest athlete that has ever lived. By far, 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 far. Like, you'd say, oh, Jordan, Kobe.
Bo Jackson.
But Bo Jackson.
But hey, let's.
There's Kareem, and he's above all of them.
And, you know, Ryan, I do actually understand your point in contention on that. But, however, it doesn't mean he did not learn that or had the ability to see that because he lost.
Sure.
You know, he very likely could have been referring to somebody else. But I do believe in the axiom that, you know, you have to have some failures in your life, that high and that low, Eddie, that you mentioned, to understand what a normal base range is.
Exactly. Absolutely.
I can't think of any human athlete that has ever lived that has had a greater impact on a team. And the reason I say that, if there's some of these programs that are trying to recreate that Showtime experience. And there's only one scene, I think, that kind of really captured it. And I think it was, and I can't remember exactly how they had laid it out, but it was Magic explaining to the whole team that Kareem could kick all of their asses at the same time.
Well, didn't you see him in the Bruce Lee movies?
Well, right. but it's real. So that's what, like you, Chuck. So, for example, you're bigger and stronger, and you as far as you'd be like a Kareem for me if I was on your team, and I could see myself saying to the teammates, guys, do whatever he says because we don't want him upset, right? That's how I see Kareem. That's how I put you in that category. Well, is that
I'm humbled that you would.
Well,
even
you're
say
tough
that.
Enough. You're tough enough to forge followers organically. I guess is kind of a maybe. There's in people that are like Eddie, for example. I'm not going to follow Eddie because he can kick my ass. I don't know if he knows karate or not, but I'm pretty sure I can kick Eddie's ass. I know I can't kick your ass. I'm not sure about you. So, I want to go down this little rabbit hole is we lock that door and one of us is leaving. What's your first thought?
I'm leaving. You guys are
next
down.
Thought. Next
You're
thought.
Gone.
What's your next thought? What's your first move? What's your first move? Because I already know my
take
first
the biggest
move.
Guy out first. Take the biggest guy out first. No, at the end of the day, you know, when we're talking about survival and getting along even in this life, I'm really kind of thinking that pick my battles. You know, is it a political argument? I'm as guilty and sometimes more because I do take some things to heart. But yet it's a battle that I don't even care to go into, you know? Pick your battles because life is way too short. And I'm learning that to this day, as some of my friends will see this and they'll be going, yeah, right, you know, because I have an opinion. But, you know, ultimately, I'm choosing better to pick my battles at my age.
One of the things I'm working on in my old age is judgment. And I kind of think of myself as a coach and as a father, and I'm always judging everybody, right? And now in one of my focuses is to try and not judge. And to tell you the truth, that's helped me with some of the anxiety that I've had, the road rage, that kind of shit. But anyway, I want to just really quickly jump back to the book I mentioned, Eat That Frog. And I highly recommend it to anybody that is struggling with time management. It's the whole book is time management. And what basically they get into is that you automatically have to give some things up. You automatically have too much going on. But you're likely procrastinating on the most important thing in your life right now. I picked up that book And within the first chapter, I started eating this frog that is the most important thing in my life. Well, I realized I have two frogs, and they mention that in the book too. If you have two frogs, eat the ugliest one first. That's a quote right out of the book. So anyway, this has really helped me in my focus and for what I'm doing and the projects that I'm working on. So I hope I explained it well enough that I can ask you, what's your biggest frog, and what's your second biggest frog?
I think my biggest frog is probably, it has to do with not letting distractions come in, but I know that's not necessarily something I'm procrastinating on, but it's just staying focused and not getting distracted by the money, and really just trying to focus on, you know, who do I want to be around, what do I want to be, and not maybe like what paycheck am I going to get out of this. As far as something I'm procrastinating on, I'm going to be honest. I think like I was procrastinating on making this decision to go to Oregon. I think it's been a long time, and I think I actually did eat that frog. And I'm a 30-year-old intern. Everyone else around me is, students still, just out of college, gaining experience. But I think it's all in the right time at the same time, because I'm in a position where I could share my experience from the private sector, from the high school sector, as an older intern, kind of taking a step back to see, you know, what I want out of this. And at the same time, I feel like I'm able to provide more value. So, but I feel like I did eat the frog of, you know, wanting to jump into the college coaching world, something I've always wanted to do. And it may be me coming back, it may be me getting a college job, but, I'll at least have peace of mind after this. So,
I like that.
Yeah, I mean, knowing what I know about you, Kayvon, I think all you need is a chance maybe you have that at Oregon, but, if I had any say in an administration, you would be with my organization no matter what. I mean, you're just too good to – that's what I say is you're too good to let go from CDM. I don't know how that happened. I didn't know about it, actually. So.
Yeah.
But gosh, I'd love to see you come back to CDM or see you at UCLA or somewhere in Southern California.
Once he's finished with the NFL and can be done, and then come on back home.
Yeah. That's the dream job, man.
So, you're right. Yeah.
I applied to like NFL internternships here and there, so we'll see. Like I kind of at this point, I don't know. It kind of seems like a stress provoked, but I've never like reached out and applied for so many jobs at once. I think it's, I'm not procrastinating. That's for sure. I feel like
so that's your focus now, full time employment with a team, whether it be in the NFL or the
college,
and it could be track or football.
It could be track or football, and if it was football, it'd be strength and conditioning with football. You know, I want to stay in kind of the, you know, where my passion is making teams, making people faster, changing the running so they stay healthier. And, yeah.
Perfect. Chuck, what frog is on your plate, and why have you not taken fork and knife to it yet? What are you procrastinating on, Chuck?
Well, just to kind of answer the general statement of how I believe that a lot of procrastination begins, and that is fear of the unknown. I would have asked you, you filled out that one application, then you said, I filled out more than I have. I would guess that every application was a little easier as that familiarity grew. I grew up in a very wonderful community, and unfortunately, my family did not have the money. Even though we lived in a beautiful area, my father was an alcoholic, and he ended up dying a sober man, so very, very happy about that. But one of my biggest frogs was rejection and fear of rejection, and the fact that I was trying to make so many people happy that my interests and my thoughts would cross each other because I was aiming to please so many people. So the frog I've eaten, so to speak, is that I'm here to please my wife. No innuendos intended, but I'm here to please my family unit, which is simply my wife and my cats. and my squirrels.
You know, there's a
and birds.
There was a study done
and
a number of years ago, and they asked people on their deathbeds, they said, what's your greatest regret in life? And overwhelmingly, the answer was, my greatest regret in life was not living a life true to myself. Which is what you just said. You just said that most people live these lives of obligation. They feel like or over consideration for others. They make decisions based on whether they think someone else is going to be mad at them, or if they feel like they need to do this for this person or that person or this. But what people fail to do is they fail to take themselves into account. Throughout their lives, they fail to take themselves, 100%. Their family members, and the closest ones to them into account. And then when they're lying on their deathbeds, they realize that they made no decisions for themselves, that they've made all the decisions in their lives out of consideration for somebody else.
In my case, that was trying to make my father happy, who had vastly different interests other than his family.
Right.
I love my father. You know, I was there at his very last moment of passing and had to help facilitate that. But it was always growing up and trying to make him happy. And I wish I had known what I know now, mm-hmm. is that the problem was his, not mine.
Yes.
And that making him happy, he wouldn't have known if I had won a CIF title or if I didn't even make varsity in my senior year. And so for me, that was a very difficult thing to overcome as a young man. And I'll be honest, one of the things that just about shattered my world when I was coaching before I left for 28 years was coming back from a baseball game with a friend of mine, and essentially him saying to me, after asking me for advice on dating, and we were going back and forth, and he eventually said, well, Chuck, you don't know, you're just a swim coach. And that was shattering to me. And that was in my mid-20s. And it was at that day that I finally said, you know what, number one, this Newport Beach area and stuff, it's just not for me. So I moved to Hawaii, and that's where my healing started to come around, to understand the bigger issues in life. And maybe not the bigger issues, but the more important issues. And those were finding my inner happiness. No offense to the women of California, but I just knew that they were not going to be, you know, of the same values and cores, at least as I was growing up. I didn't find anyone of that, so maybe I just didn't get lucky and find the right one. But when I moved to Hawaii and the values of life and what was truly important is what brought me to where I am today. And I can go on and on, but...
I was talking about this with somebody in Sedona, Arizona. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been there?
I have not, but I've been all around other parts of Arizona. And
okay, so have you been to Sedona, Arizona? They advertise these vortexes. Have you ever heard of the vortex?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so I believe in these vortexes, and this that's a rabbit hole I'd like to go down someday with the vortexes. But you go to Sedona, and they say, okay, go up this path, and you'll feel this vortex, right? And they sell these little crystals or whatever to as a. So anyway, I took all my kids, and I made them stand at this area, and they all think I'm nuts, but I believe in it. Now, going back to Hawaii, and you end up living in Hawaii, I truly believe the entire island of Hawaii is a vortex. So it's not just one, all of the islands in Hawaii is one big vortex, as far as I'm concerned.
I could not agree with you more.
Okay, so you kind of feel what I'm saying about that. In Hawaii, there's a vibration. Like, you can feel the fucking vibration there. It's crazy.
In Hawaii, they call it mana. It is the power, the force. And I'll be honest with you, I was not grown up in religion. I found the closest thing to religion when I moved to Hawaii, and that's spirituality. Mm-hmm. And since then, I have become a big fan and reader of Buddhism, Taoism. I've read the Bible and refer back to it quite often, though I can't say in the terms of Bible that I am a good Christian, but it is that openness and that accepting and understanding of different life's spiritual forces that really people should rely on more. I believe I was born a shaman, and that's a whole nother podcast. But
let's go.
I've had visions of flight since I was about 3 years old. literally controlled flight, being able to fly over, not just, oh, I'm hovering. I mean, controlled flights through ancient worlds. And it's, I couldn't agree with you more.
All right.
Again, I'm just going to stop right now.
Well, no, we'll stop. Eddie and I, we're collaborating on a show that we're talking about going down a rabbit holes of history and significance of what we call the ripples of the fabric of time and that kind of thing. And one of the projects we're working on is how King Kamehameha unified the islands.
Mm-hmm.
It's we're going to do a whole thing on that. And there's a guy named, well, I don't even want to reveal it yet, because there's a story to the unification of those islands. It's really an interesting rabbit hole. We'll talk about that another time.
Sure.
But I did want to just really quick jump back to you, Kayvon, again, because I'm so interested in what you have experienced with the growth of an elite athlete. Because I've seen what you did. I saw what you did with high school athletes. Okay, I could see you take a 14-year-old, and by the time he's 18, and all that growth, and they're now a different person. They've grown into something down with your support. Well, then you move them into, say, a freshman at UCLA. Okay,
yep.
And now they have some sort of extra training. What's the difference? What's the leap there? Because I mean, I experienced it when I was an athlete. I remember there was a leap. It was almost like a sink or swim type of leap, but I can't remember. But it was, you become different. Once you're in college, you're just a different person. What's your take on that?
I think it is sink or swim, and a lot of people do sink, but I think it's lifestyle. So you know, everyone's doing the same thing. Everyone's running. Everyone's lifting weights. Everyone's, you know, going through their playbook, but a lot of it's lifestyle. Do you really care? And are you really making the sacrifices? You know, are you going to sleep on time, waking up early? Because you can throw a Normatec boots on or ice or roll out as much as you want and stretch as much as you want. But if you're not getting enough sleep, are you going to stay healthy? You know, so are you going to sleep on time? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you doing all the little things, nutrition, hydration, you know, not drinking, not smoking, you know, all those things that you got to sacrifice that go into your lifestyle, I think ultimately, you know, makes or breaks you. Everyone's a good athlete at the Division I level, and not everyone's going to make it to the NFL. But, you know, you give yourself a better shot if you have a good lifestyle, I think.
Let's dive into some of those components. So sleep is big. I'm a big on sleep. And let's just say, okay, get more sleep, get better sleep.
Yeah.
Let's just say and leave it at that. Go to nutrition. Everybody's talking about creatine. Give us a lesson on nutrition.
I think
and give it to us as if we're a 14-year-old, an 18-year-old, and a 22-year-old.
14-year-old, you know, wake up and eat breakfast. You know, just get enough calories in, calories out. It's just, I think a lot of high school kids aren't eating enough. You know, 18-year-old going into college, if you're going to a Division I school, they're feeding you, you know, with your meal plan. But like, are you following your meal plan? You know, are you taking your creatine? Are you taking your protein shakes? I think it's, just more about, you know, eating healthy and not eating shitty food. You could get distracted eating McDonald's and like snacking at home on your own the whole time. But it's like, you know, are you putting good stuff in your body? And the same thing with longevity through your career for, you know, a professional athlete. You know, at that point, you know, everything's their decision. It's what do they want to do? But I think sleep's, you know, the biggest component. And like, are these guys going out and partying, or are they, you know, getting to bed on time and, you know, having a better, healthier lifestyle through, yeah.
Thanks. We're going to wrap this up, but yeah. I want you to wrap us up. What's your big one on sleep, nutrition? What does that bring to mind for you?
Well, getting to be almost 62, essentially just making sure I do get enough sleep. It is, and again, I'll go back to the very beginning, is disconnecting. And disconnecting, I don't watch TV, aside from the computer and all that, I watch 5%. 10% of what I used to. And instead, I listen to music before I go to bed. And again, I could listen to some of the hardest punk rock all the way down to just soft, easy jazz. To me, that's what puts my mind in preparation for a restful night's sleep. And I find that I sleep better rather than sitting on the phone and then turning it off and then just going right to sleep. Mm-hmm. As far as nutrition, luckily I have a wife who is a fabulous cook and always tries to get me to eat as much as I can. But I'll be honest, I'm not the best at that. And it is something I need to get more into, and just accepting supplemental vitamins and things like that. Yeah, you know, I'll be honest, I wish I was better on it, to be absolutely humble.
We all should. You know, we'll wrap this up, and I just really want to thank both of you for being here. I would give you there's an open invitation for you got to come back and talk more. I mean, we could just keep going. You know, as far as what we were trying to accomplish here was the idea that if a high school kid's watching this, what's he going to take out of it? If a Division I kid is watching this, what's he going to take out of it? And then the parents of those kids, what are they going to take out of it? And I think that you guys really provided a lot of great insight into what it means to be a good person and a community member. And I just want to tell you how appreciative I'm of both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
very happy to be here.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. What do you think, Eddie? So do we have a wrap-up song?
I think I just did that. So
it's hard to. I don't want to surrender this podcast, but I guess I will. Surrender.
Thanks for watching Weird Connections.
Thank you.
This is Ryan Weir. My name is Eddie Booz. Thanks to our guests. We'll see you guys next time. Take care, guys. Have a great night.